ought at least to have something that looks like a job, anyhow. A place, a talent, experience, and one day soon, an order to fill. His office and workroom, a cubicle really, contained a bench, tools, the piles of empty metal boxes, a small desk, and his ancient chair, a leather-covered rocking chair which had belonged to his grandfather, and then at last his father. And now he himself sat on that chair, sat day in, day out, month in, month out. He had also a single ceramic vase, short and portly, finished in a free-dripping dull blue glaze over the white biscuit. He had found it years ago and recognized it as 17th-century Japanese. He loved it, and it had never been broken, not even during the war. He seated himself now in this chair and felt it give here and there as it adjusted itself to a familiar body. The chair knew him as well as he knew the chair. It had known him all his life. Then he reached to press the button which would bring the morning's mail sliding down the tube to his desk. Reached, but then waited. What if there's nothing? He asked himself. There never is. But this could be different. It's like a batter. When he hasn't hit for a long time, you say he's due any time now. And so he is. Joe pressed the button. Three bills slid out, and with them the dingy gray packet containing today's government money, his daily dole. Government paper money, in the form of odd and ornate day when he received his gray packet of newly printed notes, he hiked as rapidly as possible to GUB, the nearest all-purpose super shopping redemption center, and transacted hasty business. He swapped the notes while they still had any worth for food, magazines, pills, a new shirt, anything, in fact, tangible. Everyone did it. Everyone had to. Holding onto government notes for even 24 hours was a self-imposed disaster, a kind of mortal suicide. Roughly, in 2 days, government money dropped 80% in its redemptive power. The man in the cubicle next to his called, "To the President's healthful longevity," a routine greeting. "Yeah," answered Joe, reflexively. Other cubicles, lots of them, level upon level. Suddenly a thought came to him. Exactly how many cubicles were there in the building? 1,000? 2 or 2.5 thousand? "I can do that today," he said to himself. "I can investigate and find out how many other cubicles there are in addition to mine. Then I'll know how many people are with me here in this building, excluding those who are off sick or have died." But first, a cigarette. He got out a packet of tobacco cigarettes, highly illegal due to the health hazard and the addictive nature of the plant in question, and started to light up. At that moment his gaze fell, as always, on the smoke sensor mounted on the wall across from him. "One puff, 10 poscreds, he said to himself. Therefore he returned then the cigarettes to his pocket, rubbed his forehead ruthlessly, trying to fathom the craving lodged deep within him, the need which had caused him to break that law several times. "What do I really yearn for?" he asked himself. "That for which oral gratification is a surrogate." Something vast, he decided. He felt the primordial hunger gape, huge-jawed, as if to cannibalize everything around him, to place what was outside inside. Thus he played. This had created for him the game. Pressing the red button, he lifted the receiver and waited while the creaking, slow relay machinery fed his phone an outside line.
"Squeeg," the phone said.
Its screen displayed non-objective colors and segments, electronic crosstalk made blurrily visible. From memory, he dialed 12 numbers, starting with the 3 which connected him with Moscow. "Vice Commissioner Saxton Gordon staff calling," he said to the Russian switchboard officer, whose face glowered at him from the miniature screen.
"More games, I suppose," the operator said.
Joe said, "A humanoid biped cannot maintain metabolic processes by means of plankton flour merely." After a glare of puritanical disapproval, the officer connected him with Gawk. The lean, bored face of the minor Soviet official confronted him. Boredom at once gave way to interest.
"A preslavny vityaz," Gawk intoned. "Dostoyny konovod tolpi biezmozgloy, prestupnaya..."
"Don't make a speech," Joe interrupted, feeling impatient. As well as surly, this was his customary morning mood.
"Prostitye,"
Gawk apologized.
"Do you have a title for me?"
Joe asked. He held his pen ready.
"The Tokyo translating computer has been tied up all morning," Gawk answered. "So I put it through the smaller one at Kobe. In some respects, Kobe is..."